Is your breakfast syrup missing an ethnic animated character on the front? Are you missing the old days when the face on the front of your pancake mix just gave you a hint of that good old feeling of antebellum? Well, get yourself a box of Not a Slave pancakes, the only pancake mix where we still have a character on the front who's, you know, not a slave. Not a Slave pancake mix. Check the cereal aisle. Yeah. All right, there they go. Welcome back. All right, traffic in Brooklyn is picking up. It's different. It's harder recording a podcast when you live in Brooklyn. I mean, filming anything in Brooklyn, New York is crazy. I have sirens that interrupt all the time. I don't even know how this is happening. Every time I get a good take for you guys, it's a miracle. It's your co-host, Joel Boyd, comedian, actor, writer. Welcome to High Power, the show where everybody comes on and tries to find the best version of themselves. We're so happy you're here. Your hair looks great. I know you're trying that thing, and your coworkers didn't believe in it, and I like it. So screw them. You know what I mean? I like it. We got a great episode, man. Today is no different. Justin Caselli, writer, director in Hollywood. A wonderful friend of mine, actually. I think we had a lot of mutual friends back in Chicago where I went to college. We just never met until we actually, I think, like a bunch of our friends forced us to hang out. It was hilarious. But yeah, this is another one of those great interviews we recorded back in 2023 once we took our hiatus. But this one's great, man. It's still relevant. Everything we talked about. Please support Justin's career, man. He's actually, I just ended up working with him. He actually directed the five-time award-winning pilot myself and Maya Cryer co-wrote and created, along with producers Ramon Hulay and Christopher McQueen, who have also been in different episodes of High Power. I'm actually going to look up which episodes they did. Hold on a second. We all made a project together, and it won five awards. It's honestly the most awarded project I've ever made, I think, in the independent film space. But myself, Maya Cryer, one of my good friends, you can listen to her episode on episode 121. Christopher McQueen, one of our producers, he also produced High Power, the film that this podcast is made from. He's on episode 123. And then Ramon Hulay, he was one of our biggest producers and champions. The Hype indie pilot would not have won all those awards and exist without Ramon Hulay. He's episode 109. But we all joined forces and made this pilot that's winning all these awards, and hopefully you get to see it if you haven't seen it. You can follow the pilot at I'm Over the Hype on Instagram and TikTok. If you're actually in the New York area, we're going to premiere our New York regional premiere. I haven't had anything screen of mine in New York City. This is a huge deal. November 8th. We're going to be premiering at the Voices Rising Film Festival. So check that out. Follow I'm Over the Hype on Instagram for those updates. Justin Caselli, please follow him on Instagram at Justin Caselli. So we got a little short intro of me and Ralph. And then you know how we do it. We got a great interview coming up with Justin Caselli. Kick back. All right. It's a good one. It's a good one. All right. Welcome to High Power.
If I could just be in several like independent romantic comedy movies, like like just the guy that's the friend, or just the guy that's the friend, or you know, like or maybe a lead, but like definitely give me an A24 contract. You know, like I don't need like any major. I'm not saying I don't need it. I'm just saying. I would love to just be in a small independent films, like a plethora of them. Like, oh, Oh yeah, he's in this movie too, in this movie too. Like I would that's like the goal and vision for me, just like, okay, start off in these like small roles, like for right now. Get auditions. Like, like the vision is like get auditions, like because I'm having fun in acting class and I'm doing like the scene study, but I'm also enjoying like the work behind finding out who the character is, like, and I'm really enjoying like I did Raisin in the Sun, like for the last scene study, and it was just like I played like, Asagai, and I was like, okay, what do I do? Like, who is this guy? And then I like write a journal for this guy. Like, I'm the guy. Like, I'm writing a journal and then listen to Afro beats. And I'd be like, all right, well, this guy was a community leader in his college. So, like, okay, so he's reading books. Like, he's confident. Like, you know what I mean? And I'm like, oh, wow, I'm really getting it. And that's not even like, and the accent is just like the plus. Like, you know what I mean? I'm not even trying to accomplish, I'm just like the character. So now this week, I have a different scene where I'm playing like a CEO in this movie, Ex Mechanica or Machina or
Oh, Ex
some
Machina.
Machina. There you go, Ex Machina, and I'm playing this character. And I remember watching that movie way back in the day. And I hate like doing any scenes that I've seen the movie recently or I know it because I don't want it to influence. So now I'm like, all right, who is this guy? And I only have the scene, and I was like, you know what? I want to know the relationship for real. Let me see if I can read the whole script so I can know why I'm saying this. So now, just for a scene study class, Joel, not even for like a scene I'm going to do for 3 weeks in a play. I just want to get into the role like so well, like because this acting coach, I don't know if he's helping me or hurting me, but I will say he does not want to direct me. But he'll direct like the other actors, like, just like, and I know what he's trying to do out of, because I feel like actors, the ones that went to school, college, they're fucked. Like they're fucked up. Like not to say they're not great, because they are. Like you could tell when people are like doing Shakespeare, you're like, oh damn, like you really, hey, your conservatory is really showing. But they don't know how to, and I credit comedy for this. They don't just know how to use the words in their own terms and just embody the character. Because they're thinking so much of, they're thinking. Like, you know what I mean? And the whole thing about acting is not to think. Like, the guy is like, yo, you gotta just breathe and be yourself and do the character. And I've just been blessed enough where I'm like, each role I get in the scene study, no matter what, I'm me, but I'm getting this character. So like what these coaches are seeing, like he doesn't want to like give me technical. So he's just like, wow, like you see how Ralph's using his imagination? Okay, like your instincts are like, da-da-da. He's just like, okay, your storytelling from comedy to acting is different. And I'm like, it's easy. Like for me, I'm watching the other scene studies. I was like, ooh, I'm watching it like TV. I love going to scene study. It's like 5 hour class, and I'm like watching every scene, and I'm like watching what these actors are doing, and like why are they doing it like this, and when they get direction, how does it affect? I feel like a lot of actors just feel too much. Like like they feel and think too much instead of just like flow. And I feel like this whole life is about human flow. Like it's like humanistic. Like that's why I was like, acting, I could do this because this aligns with everything I'm about. Like it's just like your breath work. Like once you know what you're breathing, like you're, and then being prepared. Like you know what I mean? Being prepared, not for the lines, because I'm watching directors talk about like, forget the lines, throw away the script. You guys are in the room, act. And I'm like, oh, fuck that. Hell yeah. Let's go. Like, I love when the directors are just like, all right, just say it in your own words. Fuck the script. And you're like, and you can really go because you know the characters and you could really take off. Like, and you're just like, oh, okay. I get what you want me to do.
All right, man. We got the great Justin Caselli, writer director, coming up for you guys. He's written for shows and special events on Netflix, VH1, and Peacock. He's worked with the likes of Hannibal Buress, Tank and the Bangas, and Chance the Rapper. You can keep up with him on Instagram at Justin Caselli. We'll talk to him right after this commercial break. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back to High Power Pod after a word from our sponsor. You're at home. You're kind of bored, but you need something self-affirming and positive to do with your time. That's where the Three Lines Collective comes in. The Three Lines Collective is a community-based organization that teaches creativity, confidence, and self-expression through improvisation and creative writing skills. I did improv as a kid. You know improv. You heard of it. Whose Line Is It Anyway? Wild and Out. But it really did change my life. When I was 12 years old, I started doing it and it got me in tune with myself. It is such a positive, self-expressive, self-affirming experience. They bring the spirit of improv and creativity right to your home. They sell loads of books that you can order right now, such as 50 Games to Stay Sane, Volumes 1 and 2, which are coloring books with improv games, and they truly do bring that spirit of creativity right to your home. They also do have these zines for Black businesses. So if you want to support loads of Black businesses, they have all of that information ready for you. They are unapologetically here to serve the Black community, and everyone is welcome. They also do virtual classes for improv and creative writing. All ages are welcome. You can do some for your kids. You can do something for you. I mean, they really are here to help all of us become better, more empathetic human beings. All you got to do is go to threelinescollective.com. It's Black owned. It's women led. They're community based. Feel free to purchase a book, a zine, a class, or just make a donation. For a limited time only, Three Lines Collective is offering 50% off their activity book, 50 Games to Stay Sane, Volume 2, until January 31st. All you have to do is type in the discount code SALE25. Make sure you apply that at checkout. ThreeLinesCollective.com. That's the number 3, Lines, L-I-N-E-S, Collective.com. What did you grew up in Cleveland?
I did. Yeah, I grew up in the suburbs of Cleveland, a small town called Elyria, Ohio. Elyria. My personal claim to fame is that LeBron James once dated a woman from Elyria, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
No, I was close. I was close to the fame.
Do you know the woman?
I have no idea who she is
now. Okay.
Oh, wow.
That's just the hot goss.
That's the hot goss in the town.
At the coffee shop.
Yeah, in the town square.
Is it like a pretty Black area?
Oh, no. Not at all. You know, it's about like 40 minutes from Cleveland. Pretty white suburban. It was like a pretty, you know, standard cookie cutter, white picket fence, Little League on Saturdays kind of town. There was a town just north of Elyria called Lorraine that was Black.
Lorraine sounds Black. Can we start
there? Lorraine is Black. Toni Morrison's from Lorraine. You know, like, it's Black. You know, yeah. it's Black. But no, man, I didn't grow up with a lot of Black folks around, which I guess is what my parents wanted. they wanted me to struggle. But no, they grew up in the hood. They grew up in Philly in the hood. And so they were like, we want the complete opposite experience for our children, so that when they see their cousins who also grew up in the hood, they can get made fun of. It was very white, cookie cutter.
So you, like, in school, was that the same deal? Like, were you kind of...
Yeah, I was like, the interesting thing is, so first grade through sixth grade, I went to like the school system in Elyria, but then the middle school and the high school, my parents weren't too fond of. So they sent me and all my siblings to like the town next over, which is like country. And I mean, driving tractors to school on like senior day country. Like,
hell nah, bro.
Yeah. Like, I'm talking like kids asking if my hair was Velcro country. Like,
no,
that kind of country. So we went there from middle school to high school. because they just thought it was like a better school system and, you know, yada, yada, yada. So, but yeah, I was like, I had a friend named Jordan who came in high school, and he and I were like the only Black kids in the school. There was like a, maybe a handful of others, but it was like six or seven. It was tough.
Wow.
Yeah, it was tough.
So you like, this is a weird question, but I'm very interested in your answer. Did you, when was the first time you consciously remember saying nigga? Like,
I very much remember. I remember trying it out in sixth grade.
Okay.
And I had a substitute. I'm so glad you asked. I had a substitute teacher that day, and he actually went to our church. And
the teacher went to your church.
The substitute teacher went to our church.
Were they Black?
They were Black.
Okay.
They were Black. And this was before I went to that all white school, right? So this is before that, I made that jump.
Okay.
And I remember I had a friend, I had a couple Black friends there named Travis and Nate, and we were at sixth grade. So we were like trying out, you know, these words, right? And I remember we were trying out different variations, like, and the biggest one was like Nigarachi. For some reason, that was like the one that we were like, Nigarachi. I don't know why we had to blend some like, I don't know, some other fucking language in there. But, and I remember he heard me say Nigarachi in line on the run, and he pulled me aside and said, what would your pastor think? Because we went to the same church, and I felt so guilty. And he was like, I don't want to have to like tell your mom on Sunday. And I'm like, bro, why are you doing this to me?
Wow. You're a substitute.
You're not even on salary. You're not on salary.
You don't get paid for this.
You don't have benefits, sir. Like, what are you doing? And so that was one of the first times I remember like vividly saying, again, not even nigga, wow, but like Nigarachi, like a version of that.
Which is like pretty, yeah. I don't know about y'all, but middle school is like where you're trying everything.
Everything.
Everything. You're just saying
like
shit.
He couldn't let you just have that.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
I mean, Nigarachi is a good ass term too. I ain't even lying.
That's ahead of the game.
Like, that was it, you know, up in Elyria. And so he wouldn't let me have it in front of my friends. Like, that was tough. That was tough.
Damn.
Yeah, that was tough.
Pulled you aside, said, hey, young man.
Yeah, I couldn't even like enjoy my lunch.
Yeah, of course. When you get in trouble at that age, you remember that forever.
You do. It sits with you.
Okay. What did your parents do for a living? You said they're from the hood, but they moved.
So they got out of the hood. My dad was in the military for a long time, the Air Force for a very long time. Wanted to be a pilot, but he couldn't be because at the time you couldn't be a pilot if you wore glasses. So he did the next best thing for him, which was air traffic control. So he did that for a long, long time. And then ended up, did that for a long, long time. Was running the Detroit airport for a couple of years. Like, he was really doing it. And then my mom also works in the airline industry too. She's bounced around from a couple of different airlines as well. So yeah, we have like a full, my parents are very like aviation oriented.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough. Yeah.
Wow.
But it's nice because she gets like free perks, you know, so like we can like fly, not for free, we got to like pay taxes on the flight, but like we can fly pretty cheaply, which is nice.
Still.
Yeah, you were saying that and I was like, yo, you got free flights.
Like if I wanted to fly from LA to Chicago, I could book a ticket. It is on standby, so there has to be seats available, but she has like enough seniority where like I can kind of get a little closer to the front of the line. But as long as there are seats available, I just paid the taxes on that flight and I can go to Chicago.
So nice.
Yeah. It's a nice perk. So she can never retire. Sorry, mom.
Yeah.
You got to work. You
know? Need that. I love people from Ohio. Get Cuddy.
Cuddy, man.
I'm going to see him later this year.
Oh, dope. I really do feel like he really saved me my freshman year of college.
Dang. Yeah. Yeah, explain on that. What you mean?
You know, his album came out. What was that? Dark Side of the Moon. It was just a lot about like he was going through some shit. You know, he was just going through some shit. You know, trying to like the album was a lot about like figuring out who he was and like who he wanted to be. And like, that's like the thesis of freshman year, college, mm-hmm. high school, anything. Right. Like, I definitely.
Wait, you mean is Man on the Moon one?
Man on the Moon, not Dark Side of the Moon, Man on the Moon. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. The first one.
And
I was like, Pink Floyd.
Keep I know. Ready. Yeah. I was like, that doesn't sound quite right, but I'm going to go.
Mashup.
Yeah, it was just a lot about just like, he was just going through like a really heavy depressive episode in that album. And you know, I was going through my version of that as a freshman in college. So yeah, we just connected, man. Like we just connected. Like we really hit it off, him and I. I don't think he knows, but we really had a bond. We really had a bond my freshman year.
Yeah, he's really, I think, like influential on a lot of levels. I don't know who's underrated or overrated anymore. I think I'm out of the age range of being able to be,
yeah,
right on the money with like who's popping and not. But I feel like he set a wave that I feel like culturally, fashion wise, what you can talk about in rap. Still, I feel like it's so influential in that generation.
And he's really versatile too, which I really appreciate. You know, like. You know, as in the fashion game, as a producer, as a songwriter, like his movie that just came out, like Intergalactic, like,
yeah,
like he's someone that who like really embodies like, I'm an artist, like I'm a creative person, and like well-roundedly so, you know, which I really appreciate, because I feel like we have a lot of people who do those things, who do a lot of things, but they're not necessarily good at all of those things. And so it's really dope to see him like actually flourish in a lot of different spaces.
Yeah.
Intergalactic was a good movie. I don't know if you guys saw it for real.
Oh, yeah. It was really good. It was really good.
Unexpectedly, I was like, yo, this is fire. I watched it twice.
I did too. Yeah, I got a chance to see a screening with a homie of mine at like one of the Netflix theaters in town, and he did like a little Q&A after. And he did it.
Oh, wow.
And he did something that I thought was really cool. Like, he not only, it was him and the director, but they also brought out, like, the visual effects artist, like, the lead visual effects artist, which, you know, like, the film nerd in me is like, they don't get enough love, like, but they don't. In that, like, a part of why that movie was so good was because it was, like, visually arresting and interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just appreciated, like, him just, like, giving him the space to talk about that side of the craft, you know, like, mm-hmm. You don't make an animated film without heavily relying on someone to do the animation, someone to do the visuals. But yeah, I saw it, and then I got home. I showed my girl the next day. I was like, everybody's got to see this. Like, I love that movie.
Yeah, I did the same thing. I was like, yo, you guys haven't watched this? Where are you guys at? But yeah, it's just like, it just came out. Relax.
Yeah, like... Like, my Netflix is still loading. Please give me
What was your background at first? You were like a producer for agencies? Ad agencies?
Yeah, I used to produce commercials, man. I used to produce like all types of commercials. So, you know, I moved to Chicago after, as the Brits say, university. I didn't know before I moved, I knew that I wanted to do something in film. I think I was too embarrassed at the time to like admit that I wanted to be a director, or even a writer, really.
Why is it embarrassing?
I think just because it's easy to say that, you know, it's easy to be like, I want to, it's like saying I want to be president. Like, okay, like, sure. I want to be a director. Okay, sure. Like, you can just say that, but like, I also didn't really know what it took. I didn't know what it really meant. I didn't know how. And I think I was just afraid of people just laughing, you know, honestly, and just being like, okay, Justin, like, sure, like, you can be a director. And so
who's people?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Who's laughing?
That's a great question. Like, that's a great question. There was no one that I was particularly afraid of. No one's laughter that I was afraid of. I think I was just scared. I was just scared of myself to like actually admit that I wanted to do this thing. And I think I was afraid of like how hard it might be. I was afraid of how little that I knew. And so I kind of just projected that onto the rest of the world and was kind of like, I don't want people to laugh at me. When I think in hindsight, what it really was that I was afraid to fail or be bad at it or to not achieve it, you know? So I knew that there was this idea of a producer, and I was like, okay, I have like a business degree. I feel like I could do that. Like I could kind of put the pieces together and be like the glue guy. I could do that. So I literally typed in Google like producer jobs and found this internship in Chicago at this ad agency, chopped it up. They liked me. They brought me out. They paid me to do this internship.
What'd you go to school for?
Marketing.
Wow. Okay. I see it.
Yeah, I didn't go to film school.
Yeah, it makes so much sense now. Okay.
Yeah, and so I was like, oh, I could do that. You know, I could get in that way. And so I got this producing internship, which ended up turning into like a job, like an associate producer. And then I just started learning how to make commercials. I just started learning how to like put together a production, you know, learning how to like understand briefs from client and like work with clients and talk to production companies and this and that. Like that, like honestly, like working in advertising was kind of my film school, you know. Like I didn't know how to do any of the stuff that I know how to do now, but I learned it on the job. But yeah, I was producing commercials. I had never, you know, you grew up watching TV and you see commercials, and I don't know about y'all, but I never thought about who made them. I was like, oh yeah, McDonald's.
Yeah, you thought McDonald's did it. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't think about like there was a whole like company behind it and they had a strategy and they went to go shoot it. I didn't think about that. But yeah, I was a dude that could put it together. And, you know, I worked at this agency in Chicago and one of the biggest clients was McDonald's. And, you know, it's McDonald's. They produce a ton of different content. And so I always had a job. And by that, I mean, like, I always had a project to give to somebody. Like, I was juggling 3 or 4 or 5 products at a time. And so I was hot in Chicago. Like all these post-production companies were like, hey, let's take Justin out. He got some money. He got a couple projects to give to us. Or like all these production companies would, you know, fly in the town and be like, hey, can we take you to dinner? You know, our directors would love the director of McDonald's commercial. You know, I had like the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. So it was for a while, it was great. I was living on like the top of the hill. It was great. And there weren't many Black producers anyway. So everybody knew who I was. I had all the projects, you know. It was, for a while, I was living a really good life. That's for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Da, 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 da. That boy said McDonald's. That M stands for cha-ching, nigga. Nigga said king of the hill, boy.
Man, I was making money that I shouldn't have been making at that age. Like it was crazy. Like it was really a good experience.
Just off that internship.
I got that internship. One of the producers left at the end of my internship. I slid into his role. And then I was just learning and moving up the ranks. Like, and so much of the job is just like, it's people. It's like, can I talk to you? Do I like you? You know, like any job, like especially in this industry, like in entertainment, it's like, do I like you? Can I spend time with you? Like, you know, and it's a people job. Like, yes, there was a component of like putting together a budget and a schedule. And admittedly, I was not good at that, but people liked me. And that's it. That's all you need. People like you, you know, and they're like, oh, let's see what Justin's up to. Like, you know, and that got me everything I needed. So that's kind of how I got in. But that was just a day job. You know, that was ultimately just a day job. But, you know, I was writing and directing and PAing on the weekends and in the evenings, you know, to try to actualize the dream of becoming a director and a writer, even though I was kind of still afraid to say that out loud.
Jeez. So you're on the top of the hill. What happened? What's going on? Like, how long was the Chicago run for?
About 7 years.
Oh, damn.
About 7 years, yeah.
Oh, put in work.
Yeah, I was in Chicago for a minute, and it really changed everything for me. But yeah, I was on top of the hill for like 7 years. Those first 4, specifically in advertising, were great because I was just eating it up, you know, going to all the parties, going to all the events and all this kind of stuff. So like my day job, you know, was the producing, and my side hustle was like the writing and the directing and shit like that. But then after like that midpoint, you know, I was like, all right, I feel like I've done all the things that I was going to do in advertising. I don't really want to make this a career. You know, I want to do other things. So that kind of could go on autopilot. I knew what I was doing. I knew how to do the job. People liked me. People trusted me. So I had a lot of leeway. And so by the latter half of those 7 years, my day job turned into the writing and the directing. And then my side hustle kind of felt like my day job because I could just do that in my sleep. I could just do that on autopilot. But I was really trying to get better at, all right, let's go make something. Let's go write something. Let's go collab. Let's go even produce a job that had nothing to do with advertising, but, you know, I could travel a little bit, or I could, you know, work with a musical artist or something. Like, let's go take some of these skills and apply them to the space that I really want to be in. And so, you know, I just started thinking like, all right, I feel like I'm butting up against a wall here. And I feel like I need to either figure out if I'm going to break through it or if I'm going to fall back and just kind of live this life and produce and just do some things on the side, or if I'm going to like put the producing down and really go for what I want. And that those kind of questions started coming up in like year six, year seven. And then, yeah, I had to kind of make a decision. Like, what do I want my life and career to look like? You know? And that wasn't easy. My parents, you know, old heads are like, so you had a salary,
yeah,
you got benefits, and you're gonna make a movie. You're gonna what? Work for yourself? And I'm like, actually, yeah. Like, that's kind of what.
Bro, you gotta talk about that, because I feel like those moments come up for us as artists in the most inopportune times, bro. Where like nobody really knows what you're going through, but like an email could come in that'll change your whole shit. Like, I don't want to do that at all. Yeah. You know what I mean? Or like, what was going on with you in that time where you were asking yourself those questions?
It really just started because like I was actually just having a lot of success in the indie film space. Like a lot of the products I was doing were like getting a lot of attention in festivals, and I was going to festivals. And, you know, there was a collective that I was a part of in Chicago called VAM. And we were getting our own clients. We were producing content for Apple and for like Viacom and, you know, Doc Martens. And they were hitting us up to direct and write a bunch of stuff. So I was able to do that. And I was just like, I just kind of was realizing that I don't need, like I was realizing that I could be in demand without the structure of this advertising model. Mm-hmm. And I was also realizing that I could have my name on something and take ownership of something in a way that I couldn't in advertising. So I could produce all the McDonald's commercials that I want, but they're not mine. Mm. My name's not on those. Mm-hmm. I can only do so much, you know? I can only change it so much. There's only so many times I could slip in a couple extra Black folks in the casting call. You know, there's only so many times that I could actually have an input creatively. And I think a lot of people didn't get that. They're like, but you're doing these things. You're traveling to like Vancouver to shoot, or Toronto to shoot, or Mexico City to shoot, or LA to shoot. And I'm like, yeah, but it's not mine. Mm-hmm. So at some point I have to figure out what I want, not just what is good for my career, in order to feel some sense of fulfillment. And what I found fulfillment in was when I could make my own stuff. And I was like, well, that's clear as day. That's what I got to go do. And it was scary. Like it was scary, you know, to like make that decision, not even to take the jump yet, but just to make that decision. Because once you make that decision, that's all you start thinking about. You just start, yeah, checking out, you know, you're like, all right, well, I'm done with it. They don't know I'm done with it yet, but I'm done with this, you know? And so, but yeah, that was a thing. I wanted to be able to own something. I wanted to be able to have my name, my fingerprints on something. And there was no way that I could get that in advertising. That stuff is owned by who pays for it. And that wasn't me.
Yeah. Commercial art. I know that is the goal, right? Of like what we want to do. But it's interesting what you said, because it's like, I think, like, I wonder how both of you guys, like, I want to know this from Ralph too. Like, how do you guys process? Obviously, we live in a system where these companies, studios, networks, even ad agencies, like you said, they basically profit off of like Black creativity, mm-hmm, and Black consciousness and our talent, our trend awareness. But we don't get that ownership. Like, how do you guys process that on a daily basis? Like, I know we can't change it today, like today right now, but it's like, it's something that I notice everywhere. Like, and we are in that game. You know what I mean?
The first thing that comes to mind is like Tyler Perry. Because, like, you know, as corny and as seemingly low budget and as seemingly, like, devoid of creative care that his projects are, he owns them. You know, he owns them. And a lot of Black companies or any companies that just aren't white can't always say that, because a lot of them will get backing from the larger ecosystem of, you know, the white corporate / entertainment world. Which is hard not to do, right? Like, that's where the money is. Like, it's hard to kind of compete, you know. Like, Tyler Perry is obviously, like, his own thing. But yeah, it is tricky, because, you know, you want to be able to make your own thing. You want to be able to create your own art. But if you want it to reach a certain scale, more times than not, you're going to have to get into bed with somebody else who will own at least a part of it.
Yeah, percentages.
You know, you're going to have to. Yeah, if we could change that today, we would, right? Like, we would. We'd be like, nope, we got our own ecosystem. We all own it. Like, you know.
That's generations away. That's like, and where not only that we own it and the quality is really top tier, you know, like Tyler Perry's cool, but I feel like his stories are soap operas. They're like stories, you know, like, and which is fine. It's cool. I feel like we're not there. I think it's crazy. I was just watching a Kobe Bryant interview and he's talking about his company. And I was like, man, I would be so curious to see how his company would have been doing. And because he was talking about the inequality of not only color, and he's talking with the animation space, and he's talking, and he's not saying, like, not only color, but gender. And he was just like, yo, it's so inadequate. So I'm coming in here to change the, I was like, dang, I'm so curious of, like, what his company would have looked like today, you know, like, but I mean, it's something to say, like, we don't own anything, you know, like as much as we're like, even in music, like, people are like, oh, this is my song. It's like, actually, it's Universal's song. You know what I mean? And we own your likeliness, you know, like, and we own your name. Then you're like, okay. So, like, once you get deeper into the game and you're like, who owns what? Like, you know what I mean? It's a very small percentage of, like, the creatives actually owning most of their thing. Like, remember when I remember having a conversation about Issa Rae, and I was just like, Issa Rae sold the show Insecure, like, and someone was like, yeah, so that means it's not her show anymore, it's HBO show, her name is just happens to be on it. And I was just like, oh, that's wild to me. That's it was wild to hear that.
That's true.
Yeah, to continue on with that Easter egg example, you know, the last few months, all we've been seeing is, you know, these streaming services kind of just remove shows and movies at whim, right? And you can't access them. They own them. Like,
That's crazy to me.
That's crazy. And it's in like, theory, that's
a good show and I can't find the shit.
Yeah, theory, until they put it back on.
Right. Yeah. And in theory, that could happen with, like, a show like Insecure. They could be like, all right, we're going to put this in the vault and you just can't get it. And it's like, does she have a say in that? It doesn't seem like anyone has a say in that. Otherwise, people would be like, eh, nope. Like,
bro, I'm about to start going analog and buy these DVDs, bro. I'm like, because it's going to happen, because it's like streaming. Any music that I really want to listen to, if this internet or anything shuts down, I need to own it somehow. Like, I don't know. It's kind of scary. I got to get a Walkman, bro.
I've seen people with Walkman. I'm like, y'all tripping or I'm not caught up
on what I y'all think they on to something, bro.
Yeah. Wow.
Y'all watch The Last of Us?
I did not watch it, but you can ruin it. Go ahead.
No. I'm just saying there's a world coming that I don't know, man. I think it's going to be, you're going to wish you had all of your favorite things tangibly.
And you know, I think a lot about, like, wanting to own, like, my favorite movies and albums and things like that, you know. But sometimes I'm like, man, I wish I would have started when I was, like, 10. Because now, like, you know, I'll go through, like, my playlist on Spotify and be like, I don't even know how much money it would be to own all these songs, like, in a hard copy. Like, impossible. I would have to hire, like, a hired team to go through everything. Like, it's impossible.
Yeah.
In one day, Spotify could just be like, man, we're out of money. We're shutting down. And, like,
bruh,
I'm not going to get my, like, African rock funk at. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah.
Where am I getting my Habibi funk at? I don't know.
Habibi funk. Okay. I've never heard of that one.
Ooh, some Ethiopian jazz. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Like, where am I getting that at?
Yeah, I always have a fear. When the Wi-Fi goes out of my house, just like off storms, I'm like, all right, what am I going to do? am I going to read? Am I actually going to read? Like as a hobby? Okay, cool. How am I going to do anything else? Like music, movies, like, bro. I don't want to live in that world. You know what? I don't. But it's coming, though.
Well, let me ask you this. If and when the apocalypse comes, are you fighting through it? Are you living on?
I'm gonna be honest with you. I think about this. I'm like, yo, I'm an entertainer. I have no real skills other than give people hope through the apocalypse. So, like, you know, like, I'm like, yeah, you guys, we're gonna do it. We're gonna make it. Hey, we gotta just believe. We gotta manifest. They're gonna be like, yo, shut the hell up.
Yeah, like,
did y'all know, like, so I do want to know more about this conversation, but this is related that I just found this out. Like, I was studying some history of, like, comedy recently, and I wanted to know what the history of Black comedy was further back than, like, American, you know, the kind of comedy revolution here in the 60s and, you know, all that stuff, and, like, further past vaudeville. So I researched, like, what was comedy in Africa? Like, I was just deep diving, like, what was going on? Because everything we learn about entertainment is through the European lens and, you know, the Greek comedy theater and Shakespeare and all this shit. I was like, there's no way, as funny as Black people are, naturally, what were we doing? And I found out basically that African comedy as a structure in an economical standpoint didn't really exist more than like 40-ish years ago. Like, I would even say on an economical level, not even more than 15 years ago, because the economy wasn't stable. When you think about paying, when you think about the audience that pays money to see a show or go see a movie, you know, they're paying, you know, America has always been lucky enough to have, you know, we made a lot of money off World War I and World War II. So much so that people had money to just be like, yo, I'm gonna go watch this show. I'm going to go see some entertainers. I got money to spend. I got enough money. I can take my girl out. We're going to go get a beer and whatever, see the show for 5 cents, blah, blah, blah. Even vaudeville times. Africa didn't have a stable enough economy for the middle class to go see a comedy show on a regular basis until like basically the last 15, 20 years. So like that economy wasn't even stable enough to, like, Trevor Noah is like the biggest example of that becoming successful, and he's like what, 40 or something? I don't even know how old he is. But like, even just thinking about that and compare that with the impending apocalyptic whatever's coming, right? It's like, during 2020, entertainment saved us because we're all at home, but we had Wi-Fi, right? So like, when Wi-Fi is down and that system is back to being unstable, and there is no real, you know, economy, and there is no middle class that's kind of like, we have frivolous money to spend to go see a comedian or go see a show or go see a movie. I wonder what will exist then. Like, is there a space for Ralph to be like, oh, fuck, shit's going down. Will, like, would you be able to walk outside and be like, hey, y'all, I'm doing a show.
Bro, if you don't sit your ass down, I would, are you kidding me? I would never do that. Hey, guys, I know you're struggling to find food and the rations are smaller, but if you could just spare a coin for my thoughts,
yeah.
Like, I couldn't.
So we're done? Entertainment's done, you think?
I feel like, I mean, stand-up would probably be, like, more speakeasy in a family living room where you're just joking and now you're sick. Like, entertainment, people would just use it for what it should have been in the first place, which was to help us distract yourself from being poor. Like I feel like
taking it back to like the origin of storytelling.
Yeah, like storytelling. Like, yeah, I feel like that's the only way I would survive the apocalypse. Like, no, don't kill him. He's good at night. That nigga beat you. Hey,
tell them stories, Ralph. Like, hey.
Tell them stories. Yo, that's how I'm like, yo, that's how I feel like it's going to work. Like, I'll work out, but I'm not moving logs and shit. Like, are you kidding me? Like,
don't kill him. He got stories to tell.
But Joe, I want to go back to your studying, and I want to ask you, like, so you know, I like the research that you were doing, but you were mentioning Africa's economy, and you know as well as anybody, Africa's a big ass place,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I feel like Africa is the only place in the world, perhaps. Maybe Europe does. This happens in Europe a little bit too, but I feel like Africa is the only place in the world where we don't where societally we rarely mention countries.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we rarely talk about like the North American economy or like the South American economy.
Yeah,
you know, or like I just was on Reddit and I saw something and they were just like, oh yeah, like these coal miners in Africa, and I'm like, where? Where? Are we talking Morocco? Are we talking Zimbabwe? Are we talking the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Ethiopia? Like, so I'm curious because, you know, Trevor Noah, you mentioned Trevor Noah, he's from South Africa.
Yeah, South Africa.
Were they like? I'm guessing that they perhaps were able to get to a place in their economy, in their social structure, where they had like a comedy economy, maybe perhaps quicker than like a Rwanda, where there's like history of like war and famine and all this stuff.
Right.
So like, I wonder, like, yeah, I wish there could be like a map that would show you like the in Ethiopia, the comedy economy, really kicked off in this year. And then, mm-hmm. you know, in South Africa, it was this year, because yeah, it's just so big to kind of.
Yeah. To throw it under one. Yeah, umbrella, as if you can just say, you guys right. know.
Like, I'm going to Africa for vacation.
Yeah.
Where?
You like, know.
Where are you going?
Africa.
I booked a ticket to Africa. Okay. Where? Like, you know?
Yeah, so, it's like, who? No, so that study was a collegiate study. It was mostly, I think it was based in South Africa, because you're right.
Yeah.
And that area is one of the most, like, you know, European colonized areas, unfortunately. Yeah. And it's still very, there's a lot of colorism happening there. Apartheid is still very recent. But yeah, so it even before that, what I read was like comedy in a weird way. It existed literally how you said, Ralph, like before it was people paying money to go to a comedy festival in those countries, it was people hiring somebody to come to a private event.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like, yeah, we get so-and-so, they're funny, you know, they can entertain us at this party, a rich person's party, or a restaurant, or a hotel event. But it was never like to the point where people could say, I am a comedic performer and like, you know, have a career. That's what it was. So maybe we're going back to that. I don't want to claim that, but hey.
Well, because there's also the history of like in the like feudal sense, there's also the history of comedy in the form of like jesters,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they were the only ones allowed to make fun of, you know, the royals.
Yeah.
You know, and if they went too far, then they got
yeah.
they got their heads chopped off that night.
Yo, you know, it's risky as hell.
You have to have the utmost confidence to be like, hey, I'm gonna try this joke, bro. Like, King Richard might not like it, but it's funny though, you know. And like,
that's crazy though. If you go one joke too, you ever go one joke too far with a crowd?
Too far, bro. You're killing though. Yeah. Or the king's in his feelings. Everybody's laughing. And the king's in the Jada moment, and they're like, oh shit, I'm about to die.
You're like, you try to take it back real quick, and it's like, I'm out like, there now.
I jest, Josiah. I jest.
what y'all pulling out knives for? Hey, whoa, 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 whoa.
Yo,
hey.
Whoa.
It's kids watching. Hey, my kids.
Yeah. I wonder though, like, were those jesters forced in that position, or were they like, I volunteer as tribute. Like, what was... Like,
so what it really was, I found out, was there... And this is true of most people that are funny. You get made fun of first. And then you go, oh, no. I'm funny. Y'all ain't laughing at me. Y'all gonna laugh with me now. Mm-hmm. So really, when back in the day, like medieval times, when that was happening, it was usually the person with the hunchback or the person with the short arm or, you know, like they were deformed, you know, they were different.
Yeah.
And they turned, they would often flip it. And like, you're right. They were the only person that could get away with making fun of the king, because the king would be like, ah, that's just little stubby.
That is kind of cool though. Just like this through line of like, that person, Lil Stubby, was writing the set. And y'all, as performers and comedians, y'all writing your set. Like that line of work hasn't changed.
It hasn't changed much.
It really hasn't.
It hasn't changed. Like that's kind of that's really impressive and like and kind of special in a way, in like this like big macro like humanity type of way. Like, we've always had people to come make us laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Simple as that.
How, I love you, you know, when I read an article, you were talking about like comedy being like salt and pepper.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, a lovely metaphor, because I think you were describing it in the way of like, no matter what kind of food you have, it's like, you need a little bit of this in there just so, you know, get through this part, and like you could make different spices happen.
Right.
You need how did you come to that kind of understanding for yourself as a creator, director? And then how do you use that on a project to project basis?
Yeah, it's like it kind of started happening when I noticed how easy it was for creators, especially writers and directors in the film industry, to get put in a box. Like, oh, this person does comedy, this person does horror, this person does this. Because it's easy to be able to understand what someone does if it's labeled nice and neat, right? A lot of movies and TV shows and things I like aren't just one thing. Like, I have this Jackie Brown poster behind me. It's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah.
And that movie has everything. There's thrill elements, there's crime, there's comedy, there's drama. Like, it's got everything in it. And I think one of the reasons why I love it so much, and the movies that I love so much, often just feel like real people and just real life situations, because in the span of 24 hours, I'm going to laugh. Something's going to upset me. Mm-hmm. My girl's going to come around the corner. I'm going to be like, I didn't see you there. I'm going to have a little horror. You know, like, you can have all these emotions. And I'm like, that to me feels right. Versus, don't get me wrong, I love a good 90 minute, like, joke after joke after joke after joke, or like a good 90 minute, like, you're just gonna be scared shitless for the whole movie. Like, I love those. That's not a knock on those, but I just like to kind of create and write worlds that just have a little bit of everything. And because I love comedy so much, to me it's the perfect seasoning. It can go with anything. If you use it properly, it can go with anything. Sometimes I use the metaphor of like seasoning. Sometimes I use it as like a side dish. Like, you know, you can have a side dish for dinner if you want, and it's perfectly fine. But if you want to have a meal, then you got to add a couple different layers to it. You got to have a side dish. You got to have or you could have a meal full of side dishes, and it tastes just as good. Or you can be like, this is a drama meal with a side dish of comedy. This is a thriller meal with a side dish of comedy. And it works perfectly. And it's just really just bending genres. And I think we're starting to see more and more of that in shows, you know, like, especially in like, you know, this golden age of TV that I can't tell if we're still in or we're leaving. But like, you know, you think about a show like, you know, like Atlanta, like that is the perfect mix of like blending genres. There's comedy, there's absurdist elements, there's drama, you know, depending on an episode, you might catch some horror. You know, you get a grab bag full of genres, and it works because it feels like real life. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from, where it's like, it just feels real. It feels more grounded when it's not just, you know, one genre, one tone throughout. Mm-hmm. But don't get me wrong. If you're going to throw me some comedy for 90 minutes and it's just joke after joke after joke, I'm going to sit my ass down and have a good time.
Yeah. But you're right. Those movies don't really exist much anymore.
Yeah.
Like, was Girls Trip the last one?
Like, we're just great. It's just straight. And you know, like, even a movie like Girls Trip, where it's just straight comedy, you have to have some ebb and flow to make the comedy work. You know, you got to have a moment where someone gets in an argument, the group splits up, or, you know, something happens so that you can come back around and hit it with some more comedy from a different angle. But yeah, I don't feel like we see a lot of those kind of movies anymore. I think Seth Rogen had an interview where he just said something like, there aren't a lot of, like, in theaters, you're not seeing a lot of just, like, straight comedy movies anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know the last time it was just like, oh, this is just a comedy. That's not tied to, like, superheroes or another IP or something. Like, this is just a comedy movie for 95 minutes with, like, a very basic story. Like, we don't really see that much anymore.
I can't.
That died with, like, Adam Sandler, I think. Like, his movies, I feel like. But he even got dramatic as he progressed, you know, a little bit more. So,
yeah.
I'm trying to think of the last comedy.
But, like, movie. A lot of them will just kind of just fall into, like, streamer category and just kind of be brushed under the rug.
Yeah.
Like, Me Time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Me Time. Yeah. That was a comedy. Yeah.
Like, they're not getting the huge releases or the huge budgets or attention like they used. Like, they're not, that doesn't really happen anymore. Mm-hmm. Which awesome. You would think it would, given that, you know, what we lived through the past few years, all you want to do is...
Right, all you want to do is laugh, but weirdly, no. It ain't shit happening.
Yeah, so, but yeah, that's what I mean. Like, I really like when you can use comedy as a tool to enhance, you know, whatever you're working on. And use it to manipulate your story in a way. You know, I think it's so versatile. Comedy is so versatile, you know? It's like...
So what, like, so what's your dream project?
Ooh, my dream project. That's a great question. You know, I would love to make my version of Jackie Brown, you know? I've been jotting down ideas for years, you know, trying to figure out, like, what is that, like, that story about, like, an unexpected regular person gets caught up in some shit and doesn't save the day, but kind of saves himself. Like, what I love about Jackie Brown, she got caught up in some shit, and she's like, I'm making this money for myself. Like,
yeah.
That's some real shit. Like, that is some real shit. I'm not saving y'all niggas. I'm going away with my bag for myself. And so if I can make my version of Jackie Brown, whatever that looks like, that would be dope.
Write that script. I'm ready for this.
Yeah, I need to. I really, really need to.
You know, when you got time. I feel like all of us as creators, we're so in a rush, but really we're going to be like amazing in our 40s. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm glad you said that. Let me ask y'all this. Like, I don't know where this comes from, but I feel like I have, like, this ticking clock in my head of, like, you have to go now. This, you have to go now. Now. Do y'all feel that, or y'all just chilling?
I feel like the way we just answered it, we're like, well, you know, that's how we answered it. So I can't even say now.
You're like, I don't know.
But I have this spurts of that where it's just like, you need to catch this momentum and go. And then there's moments where you're just like, wait a minute. Like, when I'm going now, I got to do this now and do this now. Is that because I want to do it? Or is this because I'm influenced by the people around, or that I see people on the gram, like, oh, they're promoting this shit like this. Okay. Oh, I got to do it like this then. And this, instead of sitting down, slow down, be like, how am I going to really execute this? Like, and so when I am now, it's not like out of emotion, but it's out like out of fucking, like, here's the plan.
Yeah. You're so, being strategic about it. Yeah. I like that.
Yeah. I don't even like to answer questions fast. I like to, like, sit with it and then, like, well, no, I mean, in podcasts, obviously you got to, like, when someone asks me a question, like, I'll be like, let me think about that. Like, even if it's like, I have to think for it for 5 minutes, because words just want to come out fast, or, like, actions are, like, quicker than your brain is just like, oh shit, what did I do? You know what I mean? So, or what did I say? So I like to take my time and, like, and then hit it. Like,
I like that. But, a lot. I like that a lot. Yeah.
But the now parts, I feel like there's I think that's a spirit where people are like that. You feel like, oh, I got to get this out now. Like I gotta do this now, or it's never gonna be done. Like there's a part that has to be done now. And I keep bringing back Kobe Bryant. I don't know why. I've just had like an upset. Like I've just been listening to his speeches at night, and I was just like, this man didn't know he was going to die, but he knew he had to get this shit done now. That's like real. He has. Let me get the movie done now. Let me start this company now. Let me go on this podcast now. Let me write this book now. But with high quality in everything he did. So it was just like some people like Tupac would say, like they would say, like this man would record like every night, like let's get it done. Let's get it done. Let's get it done. Like, I don't know what's happening. I feel like we just got to get it done. And these guys, unfortunately, pass on because they have a spirit in them that's saying like, if I don't get it done now, it's never going to happen. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. Like, you know, but
I think it's interesting that you say those two examples, though, because those two people didn't live in the 2020s. You know what I mean? Like the feeling that you're describing of like, is the environment telling me to do everything now? Or is that me? I feel like that's a very 2020s feeling. Damn. And like those two people were prominent in eras where that was not the case. So I feel like and I think that constant ticking time bomb that you're talking about, Justin, that is, I think that's two different timers, right? Because like for us as creators with Instagram and TikTok and, you know, YouTube and all these, the social pressure of having numbers and views and followers, that's a different timer than you're talking about an internal clock. Like those guys had a otherworldly spiritual, like,
yeah, they did.
Shit, bro. I'm the only person who can say this.
They did. And that's you know, something for me to also figure out. It's just like, because there are times when I feel it ticking internally, and there are also times when I feel like, nigga, you just been on TikTok too much today.
That's what. Yeah.
You're like, you've been on the internet too much today.
Yeah. Like
you're behind and you're not, you know, and I also think that internal clock really just, it also stems from a place of like excitement, you know, and like not wanting to like blow my chance, or
passion.
You know, be like, yeah, the passion, you know, the passion of like, yo, like this could be good. Like if you just sit down and focus and da, 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 da. And it's almost just like a mindset thing. Like maybe it's not so much like a ticking clock as much as it is just like, I don't know, this might sound corny, but like a heartbeat, you know, like, is it a ticking clock that's like counting down to something? Or is it just like, oh, you're just feeling that heartbeat for that passion you have now.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's a mindset thing, but I like what you were just saying though, about like just slowing down, just allowing yourself to slow down and like, sitting with something, sitting with an answer before you speak or what have you, because it would be easy to hear that ticking clock and then be like, I just gotta go and just blurt out some bullshit and be like, I did it. But like, did you, you know, yeah. Like, is it good? Is it up to your standard? Is it full of your passion and your heart and all of that? You know, it's one thing to move quickly, but it's another thing to move like with intention.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I keep saying to myself recently, like in the morning when I wake up, I'm like, yo, we gotta be accurate.
Ooh, be accurate.
We gotta be accurate, bro. Like, I think Maya Cryer, one of our good mutual friends, she used to, I don't remember in what context she said that to me, but she's talking about herself. And I was like, oh shit, am I accurate? Like, I wanna be. And also, I'm realizing with all of that stuff too, I'm like, with all that external pressure, this industry makes you think you have to be on that, bro. They make you think for real, hey, the window's closing. Hey, send that. We need it right now. It's not fucking true.
It's not true. You know, and like you mentioned, like being in your, like, you know, feeling like the 40s are going to be when, you know, things pop off. It's like something that I can't stand to hear is that, you know, I'll be like, oh, I want to get like this success now. I want to get it now. And then someone will just be like, yeah, but like Ava DuVernay didn't make her first movie until she was like 47. And I'm like, I don't want to make my first movie when I'm 47. I want to make it now. Like, I want to make it now. I don't want to wait. I don't want to be 47. I want to be young and spry and be like, hey, you know, I want to do that shit now. But I also get the sentiment behind what they're saying is that like that time and age shit doesn't matter. Like, that doesn't matter. Like,
and we age gracefully. We black folks,
you know, what I'm saying, take care of our skin. Right, a couple, you know, so it's like, and it's like that shit doesn't matter. Like, what matters is just like, is it the time for you? Are you ready? Are you prepared? Are you full of that passion? That's what ultimately matters. Not the year you were born. You know, it's like, not everybody's gonna blow up when they're 22. You know, I missed that boat. You know, so I can't want that anymore. Mm-hmm. If that's 47, go be it.
Yo, that long side.
you know, but
hey, but we lucky, man. I mean, hey, like if Ava could do that, as it's harder on women that age. I can't lie. Like, man, they got to keep their shit a secret. Black men have to keep their age a secret a little bit in Hollywood, but not nearly as much as women. So, hey, man,
that's true. Hey,
if we got gray beards by the time it all goes down, I'll be cool with that.
That's cool. You know, a little salt and pepper, man. That's cool. I'm down with that.
I've never seen a young Morgan Freeman, so I don't know what age he's like. That nigga give me hope, bro.
Like, he started when he was like 65. He was like, he was fine acting, you know, and then he was the
boy. You know what I mean? And he's still acting like he's 27 in these streets, bro. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's outside.
Still got the earring and everything.
You know? No, I'm like, yo.
I want to talk about your directing process.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so specifically, and I don't know where your brain is going to go with this, but I rewatched one of your biggest breaks, the Pearl Milling Company commercial.
Yeah.
Where Aunt Jemima was rebranding.
Yep.
It's a big deal.
Oh, right? Shit.
They called Justin.
Did they really?
They did indeed. They did indeed.
All right, dude, you got to walk us through that. Like, they told you they're getting rid of Aunt Jemima with you, and they need Justin. They're like, hey, listen, Chad, I know you're up, but this is his calling. It is his ministry.
Is this Ryan Coogler? No, thanks. They don't eat pancakes in Wakanda, I don't think. So that was an amazing experience. For a couple of reasons. One, because they actually called me to produce at first. And I said no. And that was, you know, that was 2021, and a nigga needed some money. So that was a crazy thing for me to say no to, because I knew it was gonna be a good paying job. But I was like, this, if I keep allowing people to see me as a producer and not a director, I'm never going to be a director. I'm never going to get the respect as a director that I want. And so I said no originally. And it's funny because my girl, Alana, was like, well, just ask him if you can direct. And I was like, little lady, that's not how that works. But I did. And it is.
Yo, they be knowing, bro.
So I didn't ask, but I did pitch myself. I was like, hey, but you know, I'm a director. I think I could really do this project. A few weeks go by and they actually come back and they're like, hey, if you have like a production company to work with, you know, we'd love to get you in the mix, you know, because I don't know if you know or not, but for commercials, almost every single job is a triple bid situation, meaning there's three directors that the agency or the brand is choosing from. They get three treatments, they get three budgets, and they essentially choose which direction they want to go in. So almost every single job, you're up against two other directors. Wow. And so I had no idea if I was going to get it or not. I just was happy to be in the mix. Had a couple directors calls with them where they asked my ideas and my process. I walked through my treatment and everything. And I was at home with the family, actually, just visiting for a weekend. And got the call that I got the job. And that was a wonderful time to celebrate being at home. Like, it was a really lovely timing. My girl sent me flowers. My mom went out to the store and bought a bunch of pancake mix.
I knew it.
Oh. You know, like it was really dope. You know, and then another special component of that was that they wanted to shoot in Chicago, which to me felt like a really, really special homecoming because that's where I got my start in that business anyway. And we actually filmed at a location like around the block from my very first internship. And so on one of my days off, I walked down the street to that first job and just kind of sat in the parking lot and was like, I used to literally dream of
being a director, nigga.
Director, being on the other side. And I'm here doing it.
Damn, and that shit gave me chills real quick. Well, that's wild.
That was really, 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 really special. And so we got to shoot that. And, you know, and don't get me wrong. You know, I love the experience. But I was also the same nigga that was like out here protesting in 2020. And I'm pretty sure we weren't asking them to change the name from Aunt Jemima to Pro Men. Like, I don't think we were like, change Aunt Jemima. Like, I don't think we was doing that, you know. But, you know, whatever. They did what they had to do. And it was just such a great experience, you know, to be directing something that got that much attention. After that was finished, I got signed to my very first production company as an official commercial director. So that was a lovely experience, man. And it really opened up a lot of things for me because, you know, I got to fix racism, you know, it's gone.
Gone. Yo, that was you?
It's done.
I appreciate that. My kids appreciate it. My grandkids appreciate it. It's over.
Got you. It's over. You know. So go to the store. You know, get some pro milling mix, and you won't taste any racism. I was actually just talking to a friend. She was like, but the crazy thing is, the best part of going to places like Cracker Barrel is that they sprinkle in a little bit of racism, and that's why that shit tastes so good. And
a little bit.
Wrong, though. You're not wrong.
I was not mad at Aunt Jemima. I didn't even think of it as a.
I wasn't mad either.
Pearl Milling.
Pearl Milling Company, which I guess is the name of the place that she worked that at.
Whipped like the slaves? Oh, no, never mind.
Like it's I don't know, but I'm like, yeah, I feel like on the list of Black folks priorities, pro milling was like at the box.
Screen. Yeah, that wasn't even in the top 100.
No, it was not.
I don't think it was on the list. White people were like, what to do?
2020 was rough.
I'm not enjoying my breakfast anymore. How about you guys?
Yo, deadass. There was a Black lady during the pandemic on the syrup. Like a white family just has a Black lady syrup. And they're like, yeah, this got to go. We cannot. We cannot.
George Floyd would have wanted this.
Yo, we did our part. My husband's part of the committee that changed Aunt Jemima.
Honey, throw away the syrup. Honey, throw it away. It's like, no one asked for that.
That was low-key the best syrup, too, though, low-key.
Yeah, bro. They really feel like that. Well, dude, thank you, man, for saving the world. I think your documentary...
I can only do so much, you know?
Like, I mean, the Marvel movie about, you know, it's coming. You know what I'm saying? It's going
to
be you saving...
I'm waiting for Kevin Feige to call. I know he eats pancakes. I don't know why I haven't gotten that.
But no, seriously, man... I can't wait to work with you more, bro. I'm a fan. I'm thankful to be your friend, collaborator, and to see you grow, man. It's kind of insane. I think we had so many mutual friends early on that people were just pushing us together.
I don't know if you remember this. You know Joel? Hang out with Joel, and I was like, okay, I'll call him.
Very weird.
Yeah. Very weird, but it was necessary.
Chicago Black love is very prominent. We stick together.
Absolutely.
But yeah, man, thank y'all for listening. You guys know who we are, High Power Pod on IG. You can hear all the episodes at highpowerpod.com. We'll see y'all next time.
Hey, so this podcast was originally sponsored by Not a Slave Pancake Mix, but halfway through the podcast, they actually changed their branding because they really felt like that was the best way for them to combat the systemic caste system in our country. They just decided to change the name of the syrup. So anyway, go buy a bottle of Racism's Done pancake syrup. Check the cereal aisle.